Hello and welcome to the Beyond podcast and this special discussing episode. I am your host, Robert Crichton, and today we are moving into what I call phase two of our look at plays written by women in the 16th and 17th century. We have, by the time this all goes out, we should have completed our first box set of tragedies by three women writers, either in translation or as an original work, with the release of Iphigenia, Tragedies of Antony and Mariam. And our next phase is, of course, to do all this again, but do it better and to be having these plays produced on stages, not just on the podcast. And to facilitate that, I'm kind of wanting to go back to, if not the beginning, but a beginning, with some interviews with people who have worked specifically on these texts and made them happen. So I have a wonderful guest with me who is here to talk about some of these plays. So my wonderful guest, who are you and what is your purpose in life?
Hi, I'm Marion Wynne Davis, and I'm a professor of English literature at the University of Surrey. I teach Renaissance literature and I also teach creative writing, which is great fun. In terms of my research, I work on early modern women writers, and I've done that now for quite a long time, since the 1990s, with the publication of the collection of play texts, Renaissance Drama by Women, that I edited along with my colleague and friend, Susan Serizano, from Colgate University in the States. That was kind of the first way that I got into early modern women writers, but I've done a lot of work since then. I really enjoy working on it. My current research is working on the early modern women writers and how they experienced London and how that experience is reflected in their works, both dramatic and prose. So that's, I think that's about me.
Lovely. Well, I'm going to slightly embarrass you now. I don't know if this is embarrassing. I have a copy. The listeners at home cannot see. I've just held up my copy of Renaissance Drama by Women, which I picked up in the when I was at university in the early noughties, I think. I am afraid I bought it secondhand. I'm afraid to say it cost £2 in that bookshop in either the late 90s or early noughties. It is now selling for, at least the hardback edition is selling for considerably more, but it is still available online at a reasonable price, and I do recommend it. This volume was pretty much the beginning of the work that I do here. I started with this volume and did a reading of The Tragedy of Antony and The Tragedy of Mariam back in 2007. There is a recording of that, but it is technically known as soup. It is quite unlistenable. And in a sense, that was the leaping off point for a lot of the work that we're doing now. And I'm just thinking back to what the world was like back in 1996 when you co-edited this book. In the introduction to the book, you do say that though there are or were editions of some of these plays, they were not necessarily in print, they weren't necessarily as available as they could be. So what was the world like then that made this volume come into being?
Well, yes, it was very different. And now we accept early modern women dramatists as part of the canon. But when Susan and I started work, they weren't really known about. And we were both just finishing our doctorates, starting postdoc work. And I was interviewed at a university in the UK for a job that I actually got. But in the questioning, and very well-meaning question, one of the interviewers said, "So tell me about the women writers of plays in your era." And then she stopped and said, "Oh, I'm really sorry. I shouldn't ask that question because there weren't any." And that was what people thought. And I went back to London where I was living, had coffee with my mate Suze at a coffee shop by Russell Square 2, which you can still go to, the Italian coffee shop. And I said, "This is amazing. There have to be women dramatists." And Suze said, "Yeah, well, let's find them." And that's how it started. And we searched for editions of by women writers that we knew. But also there's a great book by a guy called Ballard, which lists women writers, and it was published in the 18th century. And they were actually, these women writers and their plays were known about, even the ones in manuscript, in the 18th century. But they'd got lost and people didn't know about them anymore. So what we did was we set off investigating the women we knew were writers. And of course, we found Mary Sidney, Elizabeth Carey, Mary Roth, and the two Cavendish sisters, Elizabeth and Jane, and their plays. And we decided that we would publish. Routledge was really keen. This was changing the canon. One of the things I think that links back to what you said about doing the plays in class was we made a decision right at the start that we wanted to edit the plays, but we wanted to go with modernized spelling and a rationalized punctuation system, primarily because that would make the plays accessible in classroom situations, but also for readings or performance. Although that is a big debate about editing early modern texts, I think that we made the right decision because of the impact that the book has had. And people still say to me, students, oh gosh, I know you because I read your book. And even now, internationally, when I get invited to give papers at conferences, people say, oh, would you mind talking a little bit about your book? So I'm really glad that we did it. And I would like to say as well that I know it's still available cheaply, but if anybody wants copies of the plays that they want to work on or that they want to perform, they only have to email me and I'm happy to provide them. We've done that since we published the work. We've always given students and performers free copies of the plays.
That's that practical thing of having something you can hold in your hand that you can actually use in a practical way. And there are other editions that do original spelling and do the thing that the Academy is more interested in. But ultimately, these are plays and they are stageable plays and you need the materials to make that happen. I mean, that's part of my job as well, is making the materials as accessible as possible to as many people as possible. Publishing is one route and what we do is another. And since this volume, there's been a proliferation of editions of, I have multiple editions of especially Mariam, but also got at least three Tragedy of Antony's knocking about somewhere. And so the work goes on. And have you been able to see productions? This isn't a question we pre-prepared. Have you been able to see any productions that have effectively been based on your work?
Yes. I have. Talking about Antony, Alison Findlay from the University of Lancaster staged a production of Antony, a reading of Antony, in which she played Cleopatra brilliantly. And I played Eris, one of her serving maids. And it was wonderful. And the children were Alison's children, and her daughter was a baby at the time. And as Eris, the serving maid, I got to carry the baby. The scenes that the baby was on stage, of course, meant that everybody looked at the baby and very few people looked at Cleopatra. But it was really great. And there was another one, Mariam, which was directed by Stephanie Hodgson Wright. And she completely transformed it and made it about modern political warfare, just restaging it in the present. And that was not a reading, that was a performance. And she did what directors should do. She cut the text, she moved bits around, she made it applicable for a modern audience. And that was in Sheffield. And their audience was the general public, not just academics. And they loved it. It was great because people adored Mariam. But also, I think probably the most successful character in that production was Herod. And Herod was brilliant. So, yes, I have seen productions. I've also seen, although this wasn't in my book, this was in one of the editions that you're talking about, Iphigenia. And Iphigenia was edited in faithful to the manuscript form by Diane Purkis. And it's a great text. Sadly, that's gone out of print. And I think that's a great shame because I saw that used by the Rose Company in the University of Reading. And they took the production of Iphigenia out to the public as well, particularly in Lancaster. And again, they turned it into modern dress. They made it about modern political warfare, and it worked really well. I think that my text and the text of Diane in the case of Iphigenia, they're really great as starting off points. But I think the director's job is to turn the text into a performance. And that means being imaginative and free with the way that you interpret the material. It's all there, but your interpretation as the director is really important because it allows you to connect with a contemporary audience. So I think the texts are great to start off with, but productions are where it's at, really. I love production.
Yes, all three of those plays. I mean, we've worked on all of them now. I mean, Iphigenia on the page, I mean, it's not in your volume, but Iphigenia on the page, it's a very scary text because it's these blocks of prose. Some of the speech is incredibly long, and sometimes it, at a first read, it looks quite knotty and difficult to do, and it is quite difficult to do. But if you put the work in, it does come to life, and it was very powerful when we did our recording because we recorded it live. So it was one take. It was live streamed as audio on the internet. And I'm now editing all the various rushes to turn it into a thing. But it was electric. It really was. It's the thing. These are all classical or neoclassical works. They have choruses. They have a certain structure. Antony, I think the most of the three actually is the one that is quite monumental. It sort of stands very upright. And it does test the question, I don't know if you have opinions on this, of what do you do with the chorus? Are you a fan of the chorus in these plays? Because opinions vary, I think, in practical production.
I think it depends on the play. Iphigenia, I'm not sure that the chorus works as well in its entirety, but some of the comments need to be made. I think in Antony, yes, because the chorus is important for the movement of the plot. In Mariam, it's important because the chorus actually says things against Mariam. And that's something that we as an audience need to respond to, because obviously we as an audience identify with Mariam. And so when the chorus said something positive or negative about her, it is really guiding the audience response or challenging the audience, and particularly with regard to Mariam as a kind of ideal Renaissance woman, chaste, silent and obedient. And of course, she's not silent. So it's really interesting to see how the chorus can guide the audience. So I think it really depends what you do. With Lumley and Iphigenia, Lumley herself played around enormously with the chorus in terms of translating it. And so I think there's a certain sense that directors too can use the chorus as they would wish. I think with Iphigenia, I don't know, I haven't seen your production, sadly. the movement, the action can be quite fast. So to keep it moving and to keep people rushing in and on and off stage with various bits of messages and the explanations of what's happened, I think is probably more effective than having anything else.
So Tragedy of Antony obviously is a translation of Robert Garnier's play, and there are always questions of translation as to, you know, what Mary Sidney's doing with that text. So do you have any thoughts on Antony as a play and what Mary Sidney did in crafting her version?
Yes, I think it's quite accepted now in relation to translation that what we regard in the 21st century as an accurate rendition of meaning and text was not really what was understood in the 16th century. And for them, translation was a rough reworking of the original in order to make it applicable to their own time and readership. And that's what Mary Sidney was doing. So that although she's using Garnier as a starting off point, she's using it with regard to Protestant rule in England, and particularly with regard to Elizabeth I. So in many ways now we accept that she is loosely translating in order to make comments about politics and faith that were, of course, inherited by her from Philip Sidney. So it's part of her continuation of her brother's legacy and her taking on of his mantle that she wants to use Antony to make these points about politics and faith. So I think that now that's my view, but I think it's also the current scholarly view that we look at translation as loose and we try and identify the parts of the text that are relevant to the contemporary readership. I've got an example of that, if you would like me to.
Please do.
In the play, there's a lot of emphasis upon war and the Battle of Actium. And she begins with that, taking in the argument the discussion and description of the Battle of Actium from Plutarch. So there she is departing from Garnier and really setting the battle as central. And what I'd like to do is I'd just like to read to you a section about the battle. And this is Caesar saying how absolutely successful the Roman warships had been in the battle. And he says, with courage fought, fast grappled, ship with ship, charging, resisting, as their oars
his men, though lost, whom none did now direct, with courage fought, fast grappled, ship with ship, charging, resisting, as their oars would serve, with darts, with swords, with pikes, with fiery flames, so that the darkened night her starry veil upon the bloody sea had overspread, whilst yet they held, and hardly then they fell to flying on the wavy plain, all full of soldiers overwhelmed with waves. The air throughout with cries and groans did sound, the sea did blush with blood. The neighbour shores groaned, so they with shipwrecks pestered were, and floating bodies left for pleasing food to birds and beasts and fishes of the sea.
And here you get a really detailed understanding of battles at sea, warfare using galleons. And it goes on with the bodies in the sea and all the men drowned. And you think, well, where's Mary Sidney getting this? Why does she want to concentrate so much on this sea battle? And then you think, well, of course, she was very involved and concerned about the Spanish Armada, where her brother, Robert Sidney, was stationed at Gravesend waiting for the Spaniards to land. The description of the sea battle, particularly with their pikes, is really about early modern sea warfare. In a way, what she's doing is reminding her readers of the kinds of threats there have been to England through battle. And there's also siege elements which she uses. So she's bringing in contemporary material that would have been in the foreground of her readers' imaginations.
What drew me to these texts, which is sometimes the kind of thing that draws other people away, is the storytelling element to them. Is that, like you've just given us an example, people will will relate something that they've either experienced or seen as part of the narrative. And I'm a storyteller. That's sort of that I was. It was my job, was to tell stories. And I really love that about these texts, is that it's an opportunity to tell stories, as well as the story that the characters are acting in, but also to tell these images. There are so many wonderful images. I mean, wonderful, they're pretty grim images, but they're brilliantly put across as well. I mean, the lengthy descriptions of Antony's last moments, you know, it's a long speech. And I personally think you're able to create that world much more effectively than if you actually physically have those events happening. That is obviously my personal opinion. Other people may disagree.
Well, I think we have to think about how 16th century, early 17th century culture was different and how they primarily took in information, so that it was an oral culture. People were used to listening and remembering. There were so many people couldn't read and write, so that their oral memory was excellent, far superior to ours. And so when they heard descriptions, they immediately imagined them and they became powerful them and they remembered them. I think today, if Mary Sidney was writing the tragedy of Antony, she would probably she would adapt it for a movie. Mm. What she would do, because in movie culture, it's show, not tell. Mm. She would then do a flashback, which would show Antony's deathbed scene, which would be very effective in 21st century film writing. But that was not necessary in the 16th century, because people had this ability to imagine, I think, a lot more. That doesn't mean to say one's better than the other. Mm. It's just different. They had oral memory and we have visual memory.
Mm. Yes, you just need to take many of these descriptions and put them in brackets and say, this is what you are putting on the screen, as opposed to having described, or both. The end of the play is, it's an interesting potential visual here. At the end of the play, presumably, Antony's body is somewhere on the stage. And it's an interesting question as to how you stage that moment. The actor playing Antony has to lie there for presumably quite a long time and be kissed, and things happen. And it's a really interesting question about the practicality of making that one work. Obviously, not necessarily Mary Sidney's problem. It's a really interesting staging question as to what you do with the body of Antony at the end.
Yes, I think you have to have the body of Antony on stage, because the difference between the live Cleopatra and the dead Antony, and of course her choices, or the ambiguity of her choice at the end of the play, is important. Yes, getting an actor to lie on a cold floor still for a long time is quite a problem. And this is not a play that I think that you've done or that you're planning at the moment, but another play in the edition, my edition, is Mary Roth's Love's Victory. Mm. And that was staged at the end of last summer in Penshurst Place, directed by Alison Findlay. There, too, there is a scene where the two protagonists, Zella and Felices, must lie for almost the whole of the last act on the floor, dead, while the other characters mourn them. But this being a comedy, of course, they miraculously come back to life. It's a tragicomedy. But I did think about the actors as I was sitting watching them in the Great Hall in Penshurst, because they were lying on these cold stones. I think that's a testament to the stage acting of our actors, because they are capable of not just retaining vast quantities of text, as is necessary for, say, Antony, but also performing problematic positions for a very long time, which is the necessity of the director's vision from a reading of the play to a production of the play. Mm. And I admire our young actors for just taking that on board and doing it.
We have done an initial read through of Love's Victory, but we haven't as of yet staged it. And it was recorded, so there are, you can watch that production. Those out there, it is available, which is wonderful. More of that, please, from everyone who does plays. So at the end of the play, you have put in your edition, in square brackets, she dies for Cleopatra at the end. Now, does Cleopatra die in this version? Because we do have a sequel. So I just want to ask a question about that particular note.
To be honest, I think we were wrong. Okay, hands up. We square brackets means that the decision was made by myself and Susan Serizano. I suppose we were caught up in the idea that it was a tragedy and we wanted it to end with the conventional idea of early modern tragedies with lots of dead bodies on the stage. But I think we were wrong. I think that Mary Sidney leaves it as ambiguous. We don't know. And then, of course, Daniel picks up and does the tragedy of Cleopatra. So I'm very uncertain now as to whether I would have done that. I think not. And I think in some ways it's better that the ending is ambiguous and the audience can leave the theatre thinking, did she or didn't she? What's going to happen next?
I spent in tears, not able more to spend. But kiss him now. What rests me more to do? Then let me kiss you. You fair eyes, my light, front seat of honor, face most fierce, most fair. O neck, O arms, O hands, O breast, where death, O mischief, comes to choke up vital breath. A thousand kisses, thousand, thousand more, let you my mouth for honor's farewell give, that in this office weak my limbs may grow, fainting on you, and forth my soul may flow.
As you said, there's a sequel, and that's always the end, isn't it, of a first series, that you always leave it on a hanging note so that the next sequence can come. And maybe Mary Sidney was even thinking about that. I mean, she was a great patron. She worked very closely with so many writers that she might have thought that someone would, as it were, pick up the baton, move on with the idea of the thematic focus upon gender, upon faith, upon politics from her own play.
Yes, because there is a hint in Daniel's Cleopatra that there was either he was either inspired by her translation or there was an active patron nudging going on, and there's some ambiguity as to what that was. We are doing Samuel Daniel's Cleopatra. We are trying to do the sequel with a continuity cast with the parts that are contiguous. So we are hoping to see how the two go together. At some point, I might want to do a mashup and put the two plays into one orbit, but there's quite a lot of cutting to do that. So that's an ongoing thought. So yes, in the volume, we haven't even mentioned. Actually, we should have mentioned the volume opens with a translation of Seneca attributed to Elizabeth I. We have recorded that. It's a very difficult text to record. any thoughts briefly on that little text?
I don't think that Elizabeth's translation was imagined for performance in the way that we can see that the other plays that we've talked about have an idea of movement off and on stage. So you get that movement off and on stage with Lumley's Iphigenia, where the character rushes in explaining what's happened with Iphigenia and the sacrifice. You get with Mariam the fight. That fight has to happen. It's clearly imagined on stage. You get with Love's Victory, characters overhear other characters on stage. So we know that if this was staged, the two speaking characters would be at the front of the stage. And then the character who overhears has to also be on stage so the audience can see them, but is kind of hiding behind bushes. So there are elements of staging in all the others. They're actually there, so you can tell that even if they were only read, the women writers are thinking about production in their minds. I don't think that's happening with Elizabeth. I think it's more of an exercise. It's about education. It's about learning to translate. And as we know, Elizabeth had a vast number of languages. I understand that she could speak Cornish. So that's quite amazing. So I think for her, it was an education process. Although the other women who were writing were members of the nobility, even for them, writing and publishing a text was quite daring in those days. I think for a monarch, it would have been much more questionable, and that she was not there to put her words out for the general public to read, unless they were in speeches, legal documents. So I don't think that it was intended performance, and that's why it's a much more difficult text.
The love of kingdom's rule observed with care, but for himself a king but few regard. The court's lustre a stale guest made for me, delighted with the shine no woe forethought. And this man seeks the nearest room to prince, to glittering view amid the streets he comes, while broiled is with cark the miser's breast, in search of gainful grasp his name to spread.
But we decided to include a lot of material, not just the plays, because we wanted to put women's performance into context so that people realise that women were not only writing plays, they were also participating in court masques. They were going to theatres. They had economic interests in drama and theatre. So we wanted to give a sense that women were not just kind of shuttered from the theatre, but they were involved in every aspect of it. And that's why we included the document side of the overall edition, which is Renaissance Drama by Women, Text and Documents.
And there's been a lot more work since on women working practically in playhouses and owning the actual buildings themselves, and the importance actually to that of that labour to the process of getting shows on. And of course that's why you include a masque, which is written by a man but is performed primarily by women, so that the performance of women has always been that slight myth that women didn't perform. I mean, they didn't perform on the public stage, but there's plenty of women performers out there. You know, additionally, you know, things like tumblers and you know, acrobat and other kinds of performance out there, not just drama centric stuff. So let's go on to the tragedy of Mariam. My thoughts about Mariam is it almost doesn't recover from how good Act One is. I think Act One is so beautifully structured, and so because characters wander on and wander off, and they all sort of do this little dance, and they introduce so many ideas, and the play doesn't wholly recover from how good that opening is. That is perhaps unfair to the rest of the play, because there's a lot of good stuff in it. Herod, when Herod returns, spoilers for anyone who starts the play, Herod isn't dead. But yeah, it's a beautifully structured play in many ways. You have Mariam, but you also have Salome, who is such a wonderful creation in the sense of you understand exactly why she is doing the things she is doing. Salome drives the plot because she's constantly maneuvering people to do what she wants. And she has very good motivation to do those things because Mariam's quite mean to her.
I absolutely adore Mariam. I think it's a great play. I think you're right that Act One is held together by Mariam. But later on the play, once you've got Herod back, if you've got a good Herod, where Herod's kind of vacillating. Should he kill Mariam? Should he not kill Mariam? And then Salome comes in and says, oh, you fool, you know, stop messing around. And, you know, and I won't explain what happens at the end because I realize that your listeners will be wanting to hear the production. But I think that actually does work throughout, and I think it's an amazing play. It is in my edition, which we very much enjoyed doing, but also it has now been published in an Arden edition, edited by Ramona Ray. For early modern scholars, the Arden is sort of like gold standard because they're so comprehensive, they have so many texts. Their editorial processes are immensely detailed and accurate. So you get footnotes, which are helpful to researchers and helpful to undergraduates writing essays. So they're really good. The fact that Mariam is the first play written by an early modern woman that's got an Arden is right. I hope there will be a lot more. But it also means, you know, that we can now read it in depth. And I really enjoy the female characters. It's interesting to me that you talk about Act One, which is held by Mariam. And if you've got a good Mariam, then you're there. And Salome, who is clearly the other to Mariam. And that's quite interesting because when you look at most early modern plays, that kind of dialectic, the oppositions are taken by a man and a woman, which is much more common, but not in Mariam. Herod doesn't appear till much later. So you've got it really set up, and Mariam is this white ideal. Salome is this dark-skinned villain. And race plays an important part in creating that distinction. And I think there are a lot of interesting discussions to have about race with regard to the play. Also, the dialectic sets up the kind of ideal woman who is chaste, like the Virgin Mary, versus the unchaste woman, like Eve, and that is Salome. So you've got the difference between the two women immediately set up. And that, as you say, carries on right through till the end of the play. Salome is always turning out, putting her bit in, and she puts her bit in brilliantly. I mean, Carey's speeches for her are absolutely fantastic. So I think that very much the play is carried by women. I'd like to do, I don't know whether we have time to do this, is to talk a little bit about the other women in the play. Okay, because I've always thought that as a production, it's one of the best productions ever for parts for women. There are no boring parts. They're absolutely great. From Mariam, how oft with public voice have I run on? And she begins the play, which she condemns herself for speaking out, but at the same time speaks out. So her voice is going to dominate the whole of the play. And that's a really important statement. She's great. Salome, the villain, has got this amazing, very up-to-date speech about divorce. And she says, men can divorce women, so why can't I divorce my husband? Why can't we have the same? And therefore claiming equality between the sexes. That is so up to date. It really, you know, brings it up. When students read that, they're amazed that a woman was writing this at the start of the 17th century. But there she goes, and she's not punished at the end of the play.
No, she wins. She wins. I mean, there is part of me thinking that this should be called the Triumph of Salome because, you know, if we follow the history, she becomes queen. and the thing is, if she got a divorce, if they had divorce for women, none of the events of this play would happen. Almost none of the manoeuvrings that Salome feels she has to do, they're all a direct response to the fact she can't get a divorce from
conflict. He loves. I love. What then can be the cause keeps me from being the Arabian's wife? It is the principles of Moses' laws, for Constabarus still remains in life. If he, to me, did bear an earnest hate as I to him, For him though were an ease. A separating bill might free his fate from such a yoke that did so much displease. Why should such privilege to man be given? Or given to them, why barred from women then? Are men than we in greater grace with heaven? Or cannot women hate as well as men? I'll be the custom breaker, and begin to show my sex the way to freedom's door. And with an offering will I purge my sin. The law was made for none but who are poor.
And then we go, if we think back to the first act, when Mariam is talking about should she mourn for Herod because they think Herod's dead or should she not? Her mother comes in, Alexandra. And Alexandra's great. She's got these really long speeches. And, you know, she says, you fool, Mariam. You shouldn't be crying for Herod. And then she goes off on this amazing riff about how she sent Mariam's picture to Antony. And that Antony would have picked Mariam rather than Cleopatra. And this, of course, links back to Mary Sidney. So she's a great character. But then you've also got Doris, who is Herod's first wife, and he's put away Doris so that he can marry Mariam. And Doris is incensed by this. And towards the end of the play, she comes in and she curses Mariam in a very powerful manner in which she calls her painted, or she alludes to the idea of a white devil, that Mariam might look beautiful and white with blonde hair on the outside, but inside she's a devil because, in Doris's viewpoint, of course, Mariam has stolen her husband and disinherited their son. So Doris has a great viewpoint, but she also has these amazing cursing at the end of the play. You know, I will curse you with my three times my very breath. And then there's also the character Grafina. Now, everybody tends to forget Grafina because she's a maidservant and she's not terribly important. And what I wanted to do was to tell you a little bit and to quote a little bit from Grafina. And this is Grafina talking to Ferarus, Herod's brother, and she's been his maidservant and he's fallen in love with her. And she doesn't really say that much in the play, but she's got a great speech. She lays down the fact that she is the ideal of early modern womanhood. First, she says that I should say too little when I speak, for since you will not imperfection best, in spite of doubt, I will my silence break. Here she's referring to the idea that early modern women should be silent. But she, like Mariam, breaks that silence. Then she goes on to say, you have preserved me pure at my request, though you, so weak a vessel, might consume to yield to your high will. And here she's talking about the fact that he hasn't taken her chastity. They haven't had sex. But of course, for an early modern audience, that would mean that she remained chaste. And that was another element of ideal early modern womanhood. And then finally, she says, but study cannot boot, nor I require, except your lowly handmaid's steadfast love and fast obedience. May your mind delight. And here she's saying that she will be obedient to him. And that is the final element of early modern womanhood. They should be obedient. So they should be chaste, silent, and obedient. And Grafina says she is all three. So she is needed by Carey to throw into contrast the other four women. So you have women who speak, women who don't have chastity, women who are certainly not obedient. But there is Grafina saying, well, actually, this is what we should be, and this is what I am. Even though in order to show that, of course, she has to speak, thereby creating a certain autonomy and subjectivity. If you think of chastity, it's not because he hasn't wanted to make love, it's because she is asked him to keep her chaste. So you know, she's got a lot of control in this, and she's the one who decides to be an ideal. But she's necessary when you look at the five women. As I said at the start of talking about them, they are amazing parts for women. I think the female cast of early modern plays is often thinking, oh, we're going to be the secondary figures, we're going to be passive, we're going to die at the end. But here you have them, you know, being articulate, proud, independent women. That's probably one of the reasons I love the play.
It throws so many questions up. I don't think we probably have time to discuss the full spectrum of, say, race relations in this play, because everybody is a bit racist, I think is the best way of putting it, and it goes in all directions. I mean, the way that Constabaris and Silius interact is based on that as well, and the way that you almost feel that Mariam has inherited some of Alexandra's views as well on that. There's something of that, though Mariam rejects a lot of Alexandra, she has absorbed some of those things too when they both turn on Salome. It continues all the way through, because of course it's a heraldic problem. You know, it is a problem for the dynasty, for Herod, as to the legitimacy of their line. That is why he married Mariam. So that is a central fault in the play that people are wrestling with. That's why Herod has murdered quite a lot of Mariam's family. So there's that question of should she mourn him at the beginning is so topsy-turvy in that sense of, you know, what am I supposed to feel in this situation? Because obviously she has been intimate with Herod on some level, and also he's killed quite a few of her family. It's a genuine struggle that the actor has to maneuver through that opening speech. It is a shame that Mariam's mother and Grafina do not return. Alexandra gets a reference at the end in the relation of Mariam's demise. It's a tragedy. That's not a spoiler.
Yeah, I would like to take up your point about race, because I think, I know we don't have much time, but I think it's probably the most exciting area of scholarship that's developing in the UK at the moment, and that's early modern race studies. Mm. People used to think that there were no Black people of colour in London in the 16th, 17th century. That is simply not true. And so we know that Elizabeth Carey would have known people of African descent, maybe Middle Eastern descent, and she would have had a sense of what she was saying when she describes Salome's skin colour. I don't think that Carey shied away from controversy. We have to think about the fact that she was a woman of her time, and that people thought about race very differently at the start of the 17th century. But the fact that she makes Salome into such a clear, articulate, and delightful character in the way that she speaks, and the fact that she triumphs in the end, I think shows that Carey was being quite open about ideas on race. I wouldn't like to hypothesize more about this, because I really think there's so much work that we can do. And the fact that there were quite a few Black families living in Westminster at the time that Carey was there at court, she would have known them. So I think we need to actually go back and find a little bit more about Black lives in the early modern period. There's great stuff out there, but there's still a lot of work to do.
Yes, and that's pretty much the focus of where we want to go with the tragedy of Mariam next, and passing over to somebody else to look at. I mean, I'm not going to produce everything myself. I have produced Mariam a few times now, so it's time for me to pass the baton on to somebody else. So, yeah, this huge, huge areas. We have run out of time, sadly. So I'll just ask you if there's anything you'd like to close on, any recent work or things that you'd like to mention.
No more than I said at the beginning about I'm working on early modern women living in London. So Carey will be one of them, and where she lived and how she experienced London. Really looking forward to all the productions that you've got. I think it's a brilliant project. And if I can be of help in the future or participate in any way, I'm really happy to do that. And just good luck with everything. I think it's fantastic.
Thank you so much for being a wonderful guest. All that remains is to say, full cast audio adaptations, by the time this goes out, should all be available of the material that we've explicitly referenced. That should be there should be links in the show description. There are definitely readings on our YouTube channel, as well as, say, the full cast audio adaptations, and more of this kind of discussion with other people producing these plays. We keep finding people doing them, so we keep talking to them, as well as other academics and people who've studied the period in this particular area. There's so much more to explore. We will get round to that at some time. All that remains to thank my wonderful guest for being absolutely wonderful. Thank you very much, and goodbye.